Okay, let's start. Hope my voice can keep up with me. As announced, the theme of the lecture today, it will be a relatively short lecture, an hour or something, is on ethics in research. What do we mean by ethics? Why is it important? What should we think about when we consider ethical issues that has to do with research? I'm not going to focus very much on the stuff that you have been informed about earlier that has to do with plagiarism or copying, faking data, stealing information from others. That's of course also ethics, but that's not what I'm going to talk about today. What do we mean by ethics? Well, there are of course legal issues that has to do with ethics and how to perform research and what to think about. But in addition to that, the basic idea behind it is that it's not that much rule based. It's more like like ethical guidelines, issues you have to think about before you do research, and that you have to think about during research. It has to do with different issues. I mentioned a few here. I won't go extremely into detail here, but what I'll also do is that I will point out some additional resources to you during this lecture, because this is an important issue, and the amount of information on the net, checklists, guidelines, is huge. Well, the information there is very easy to access. So I'll point out some of these resources to you. Ethical concerns has to do with how you treat participants when you are performing research. If you are involving humans at any point during a research process. So how should you treat them? What should you inform them about? What issues should you think about before you involve humans in your research? That's the main issues I will talk about today. But of course there are also other issues. Even if you're not involving humans in your research, there are professional issues like faking data and that stuff, which you have probably been taught about quite a lot. Citing in sources correctly, not claiming the ownership of things that's not yours. That's of course ethical issues. I will not go further into that now. But there are a number of you could say, I say here, less serious issues, but still important stuff that has to do with what type of data do you actually you publish or present after your research? What are your links to, for instance, if you work in a company that that are funding your research as well, or funding your time, should you, it's very tempting not to publish or not to talk about research that has outcomes that's not very pleasant for the company that's funding you. And doing that is also considered a very serious threat to research. So, as you will see in some of the sources I will point out later, issues that has to do with your loyalties. Who is funding you? Who is supporting your research? What are your loyalties? Are issues that that are considered quite central in when you're going to perform ethical sound research. There are also a number of issues that has to do with you could say the relationship between science and society, that well, your research should be worthwhile. Well, it should be worth the effort that you put into it. You should consider the consequences of your research. It's not apolitical. It's part of the society. So when you conclude in something, someone might take advantage of that and use that for their benefits. When it comes to the treatment of participants, so this has it doesn't have an extremely long history. Very much of this work started after World War II and had to do with medical misconduct or ill treatment of patients. In the 1960s, there was an international declaration, the Helsinki Declaration, that actually stated 18 formal ethical principles for medical research, and a lot of those principles have been taken into other areas as well. So, a very central part of this declaration has to do with how we treat people, and that people that are going to take part in research should be there voluntarily. So there should be no pressure in taking part in research, and everybody should be informed so that they can show what's called informed consent in the research. It originally, this had to do with medical research, in which there are an obvious need for these rules or guidelines, but it has also been taken into other areas. So all research that's being done in the context of academic institutions like ours is supposed to follow these guidelines. When it comes to voluntary participation, there are a number of issues that may be of importance. A key thing here for informed consent is that participants, all participants, should be informed of all aspects of research that they're going to take a part in. So, in principle, you have to tell the participants all that they actually, well, more or less all you need, all you know about an experiment, and the why you perform it, why this is important, what we're going to do, and so on. Another important issue when it comes to this information is that it should also include information about the freedom to decline participation, that you actually should be allowed to say, no, I don't want to take part of this anymore. And the freedom to decline participation is supposed to be there at any time during an experiment. So even after data is collected, a participant should be able to withdraw his or her part in the data collection. That said, as I say, this is guidelines and not necessarily absolute rules. So there are, you can say that there are strategies around this. So a little bit of pressure, for instance, if it's important to have people to participate in your experiment, is okay. Trying to persuade people to take part in the experiment is okay. It's not so that you need to that you can't put a little bit of pressure on people. And of course, there are also a number of experiments where it's more or less impossible to tell people everything in advance. If you tell people that you're trying to persuade them to give up their passwords, they probably won't do that, right? So if you have those kinds of goals with your research, if you want to check out boundaries for humans' willingness to give up information or something like that, it's of course impossible for you to tell about that. Again, there are ways around this. A strategy for this that is applied now and then is to have a very thorough debriefing of subjects after your study. So you tell them afterwards what they took part in, and then they maybe can decline to give away their information. You can also give all the necessary information without actually saying whether they are part of an experiment or not, like what they do in typically in medical research when they apply control groups in blind experiments. Well, you honestly tell them that some of you are going to get medication that works, some are going to get a pill that doesn't work. I don't know which group you will be part of, neither do your nurse who's administering these medicines. But it will of course be conveyed to you afterwards whether you were part of the group that got working medications or not. Then you have submitted all the information you actually have without telling people that what kind of experiment they're part in. So applying strategies for that can be a way around this problem of too much information that might influence the study itself. Let me just see. Another consideration that's often mentioned when it comes to research ethics that not necessarily has to do with either privacy nor voluntary participation is, there are issues that has to do with cost-benefit stuff in your study. Of course, if things are harmful, is it worth it to do the study? If there is a potential of harm involved, Well, probably not. Well, then the the cost is higher than, you could say, the benefit or the outcome of the study. But there are other issues as well that's not that obvious. That hasn't to do with physical harm or anything. If you require, or if you try to have persuade people within a company, for instance, to use a lot of time, you have to interview them. They have to answer huge questionnaires. They have to come to your office to be interviewed. Well, you're stealing a lot of time, and it may be very costly. It may cost a lot of money for an employer. So you should consider whether the outcome of your research, the results that you plan to get to in the end, are they so important that you actually should steal that much time from people? You should consider it. There are other harmful things as well, or harmful in a not direct literal sense. When you do, well, some of you are in the area of interaction design and do usability studies, stuff like that, have people to perform things, maybe in a lab setting or something, on software that is not completely developed, that has solutions that's not necessarily the smartest solutions. And you may actually make people feel quite stupid when they can't perform the tasks they were supposed to perform. So, is it worth it? You should consider it. This is an issue let's say you're making people perform some kind of a test of skills or something. You want to test them. You want to put people into different categories and perform kinds of it could be intelligence tests, of course, but also personality tests, stuff like that. You may create situations where you discover things that the participants could very well live without. Tasks they actually can't perform because they can't solve that type of puzzle that you are confronting them with. Personality aspects that's not very pleasant to know about, that you're pretty much a bastard or something like that. Is it worth it to discover these things? Well, you have to. This is part of the, we can call it the checklist that you have to go through when you are planning your research, when people are involved. Another key aspect has to do with, and some of you, I guess, are quite involved in issues that has to do with this, and that has to do with confidentiality and anonymity in studies. Of course, it's a very basic thing. There should never be situations where when you publish research, can read out of the context who took part in the research. So people should be anonymous. But it's not always It's not always easy, these issues with privacy and confidentiality. It may be able, you may be able actually to, well, if we do a, just take an example, it's not research, but if we do a study here at the here at Gjøvik High School, if we are going to do a study on work environment for employees here, how satisfied are they with their leaders, how satisfied are they with the facilities here, we now and then want to break things down to groups, so we want to see whether there are differences in our group at IMT compared to TUL down here, compared to the administration. And we may also even split it down further into what role you have within that that part of the organization, etc. And when you do that, and when you report data at a certain level, it's quite easy for someone who reads this data to actually say that no, Frode was the one who gave this information. Or at least you could put it down to a few people. So even though you think you are not aren't conveying sensitive information or showing the source of information, it may be possible for the reader to do those deductions, and we are well, not necessarily voluntarily, but we are somewhat inclined to do this kind of things. More or less automatic, we try to infer these things when we read things and when we hear presentations. So be aware of such issues. You will get a bit of help when you are doing research on that involves humans in an academic context, because any, or more or less any study we do, where we are going to send out questionnaires, where we are going to at least trying to gather some data, that some background data on humans, we are required to notify that we are performing this research to a representative that we have that's supposed to take care of this. And in our case, and for most universities, I guess all, we should always refer to, I have to put it over there, of course, what's called the data protection official for research, Personvernombudet for forskning. And they have a lot of information available to us to tell us, or to that we have to go through to check whether the actual study that we are performing is within acceptable ethical limits. So, at any time, if we gather data that that has a link to individuals, and where their responses can be traced, for instance, if there is a if you have an ID number on the questionnaire and another separate list that links these names to the responders. At any time you have such a situation, you should report your project to the official, the data protection official for research. There are a number of studies that doesn't do this. That's completely anonymous, where you don't gather any background information on people, and where you maybe just perform interviews without taking any audio record, for instance. And then you don't have to report it, but you should anyway discuss with your supervisor whether you have to report your study or not. You also have to go through a process here where you apply for an acceptance for your study. So this needs to be done quite early in a research program if you're going to do this in your master thesis. They say that they need 6 weeks or something to approve an application for registration here. It's usually a lot faster. For most projects, it comes quite rapidly, within a few days. So it's a pretty straightforward process. So whenever if you are in doubt, register your project. You will also, through that process, be informed whether you need to apply for further approval, like to the Datatilsynet. If it's a huge project where you're going to save data for a longer period, well, then you have to go further than the data protection official. Let me just show you the no, that's not what I... Yeah, so this is a very good source of information, so I encourage you to take a look at that. There is a special. A lot of you are going to do well when you do things, when you invite people to participate in a study. There is it's very easy today to use electronic tools to do that study. Use things like QuestBack or Google Analytics or any tool that's available for this. The problem here is that any study you do that involve these things, well, you think you do it anonymously, but there is usually so that these tools they log IP addresses, for instance. And once you have that kind of registration, well, you're actually it's not completely anonymous anymore. There are ways around this so that you don't have to register your project. And there are ways of expressing this or giving this information to the participants in your study. Suggestions for this kind of information is available on the web pages that I showed you. So they suggest how you should formulate these things. For instance, telling the participants that this study is performed or is assisted by QuestBack, or data is gathered using QuestBack, the researcher will not at any time be given information on IP addresses that makes that allows the researcher to go back and trace the who has answered a questionnaire. So, but of course, if you are giving that type of information away, you must make sure that that's the case. But some of these tools allow you to do that. They can hold back that type of information. There are just the one thing here that has to do with informed consent that is needed. It has to do with, of course, net research, but it's a general thing. You should make sure that when you inform people about the study that you are doing, use a language that's understandable for the people you want to invite into the study. You tend to have a technical language behind your research. You are referring to technical terms in your academic programs. That's not necessarily straightforward to understand for the public that you want to involve in your study. So make sure that you use a language that that's understandable. I've been in, I'm coming from a discipline where people are invited to take part in studies all the time in psychology, and have been confronted with studies that where even I, with my background as a psychologist, not necessarily understand what they're after, because they use a very technical kind of internal language when they try to inform me what they're after. So when you try to do this towards people that's not of your research areas at all, this is even more important. Doctors tend to do, or medical researchers tend to do mistakes on this area all the time. I remember I was part of a study once where, I was invited to take part in a study where the aim was to look for stress hormones that had to do with physical exercise. It was argued that this was very important for people with paraplegia that had spinal cord injuries, where some of their physical exercise could, for instance, be to use a hand bike. But the hypothesis there was that they were more prone to being hurt during exercises or to muscle injuries, because their stress hormones wasn't reacting the same way as people with without paraplegia. So I was involved as a normal or a control group in this study. It provided me with huge amounts of information, a lot of details, well hidden between in these details was something about they were going to take blood samples, and that was going to be done by a intravenous catheter. I didn't take much notice in this, so I showed up at the at the hospital where the study was going to take place, and was put on an operation table. So they inserted some kind of a tube into a big vein. So, well, it was somewhat a small operation, and they were taking blood samples every 30 seconds while I was exercising. Theoretically, I should be skilled enough to understand what this was all about, but I wasn't. Was it voluntary participation? Well, I think they could have spent a bit more time in actually explaining what I was going to take part in. I should have been suspicious when they paid me a week's wage or something to take part in this for a day's work. So, anyway, even if you're not doing that kind of threatening, harmful research, be a little bit careful that people actually understand what you're after when you inform them. There are special problems with this when it comes to kids, for instance. When should kids be taking part in studies? And when can kids, out of legal considerations, give informed consent to take part in a study? There are some general rules saying that 15-year-olds can do it themselves. If they're younger, you need to involve parents. But there are also a lot more details on this. let's spend a little bit of time in the end here. I will continue a bit over time here now, and let's end it so we don't take a break here. But I won't spend more than maybe 15 minutes more. Deceptive research is the name that we use for research where you can't and won't convey all the information to the participants while you do the study. A very good example of this, a very famous example of deceptive research. There's a number of them in my area, but I know that a lot of people here from information security, for instance, have done studies that has to do with stuff like what they call social engineering, how you can trick people into give away information that they otherwise say they won't give away. How you can create situations for people, making them give away information. and to be able to find out something about this, well, then you have to deceive people. You can't tell them everything. And a very famous example that's often used to describe this dilemma and some of the considerations you have to go through comes from my field of psychology. I'm not sure if you all have heard about Stanley Milgram's famous experiment on obedience, done in the early 60s, I think it was in 62. At Yale University, he wanted to investigate cruelty among humans. Why did German soldiers during World War II commit their really terrible acts in concentration camps, for instance? How could they do this? Well, it was said that the general thing was a general idea at the time was that this couldn't happen everywhere. This may have something to do with culture. It may have something to do with a very authoritative culture that was in Germany compared to a more free and could say democratic or open society like the American society. So it couldn't happen there. That was the general thing. Cruelty was obedience to authorities wasn't something that could take place everywhere. So Stanley Milgram was trying to investigate this, and what he did was that he performed an experiment where he invited a number of volunteers to take part in a study. Let me see, I think I took up some. So he made a public announcement saying that he was going to perform a study on learning, on memory, and strategies for teaching people how to remember information better. So he set up an experiment where he invited some volunteers to spend an hour with him. They were not supposed to be high school students or anything, which is the normal population for these types of studies. And he, I think he recruited some 40 normal males between 20 and 50 and paid them $4 to take part in this study. $4 was quite a bit of money in 1962. When the students came to his lab, he was deceiving them. He told them that this was a memory experiment. Of course it wasn't. And he also told people that you will now either get the role of a teacher or the role of a student. So he came there with another person in the lab. Stanley Milgram himself was standing there in a white laboratory coat. So looked like a doctor, looked like an authority. And he told them that, well, you will now either be a teacher or a student. Of course, this was also a trick, because one of these were a colleague of Milgram, and this person always got the role as a student, and were placed in a separate room from the teacher that Milgram had as a test subject here. And the task was quite simple, he told them. You're going to read a number of words, I think it was, and the student in the other room is going to repeat this to you. Whenever he does a mistake, I will inform you about that, and you will punish the student. So he thought that he was going to punish the student. And he was going to do that in a very, obvious way. He was going to push buttons on an apparatus like this. There were a number of buttons here. It's difficult to see here, but they were labeled from slight shock through very strong shock. And then there were some orange letters up here saying extreme intensity, and it ends with a number of X's. So it indicates that this is potentially lethal, what you're going to do here. So the dependent variable here then for Milgram is how high on this scale are the participants willing to go when they punish the subject. And to his astonishment, the number of white, normal American males that were willing to do this in the 1960s was 65%. 65% were willing to give something that was perceived as lethal shocks to participants there, or to a student. The student was also shouting and well, expressing pain quite obviously, and very at in the end here in situations where, well, he played that that he wasn't anymore, he wasn't able to respond to the tasks anymore. But even in that situation, a lot of these participants were willing to go into potentially giving lethal shocks. So was it ethical what he did? What do you think? What considerations did he have to do here? It's an extreme example, of course, but well, many will say no. And what so in this case, it actually came as somewhat a shock for Milgram as well, the outcome. You can see this experiment if you search for Milgram and obedience. You can see a number of YouTube presentations of this. Some of them are quite good as well, because this experiment was well documented. But what happened in the beginning there was that a lot of the participants, they were really crushed afterwards. And in the beginning, Milgram wasn't expecting this, so he just sent them home right after the experiment. And that's some of the critique that has to do with ethics here. And what Milgram had to do there was to apply a strategy for this. Well, he had to afterwards give them all the information, tell them about the normality of what they have done was, tell them that, well, yeah, I was pushing you towards your limits here and over your limits. But this was important. It's not only you who would have gone so far. A lot of people would have gone so far. So he was, you could say, desensitizing the test subjects afterwards. So that became his strategy. Another issue, of course, has to do with was it worth it? The cost-benefit considerations here. Maybe. It's considered one of the most important social psychological experiments ever performed. Its consequences, what we learn from this is that we are not as moral as we tend to think we are. So, well, you could... not all research is that important. In this case, it was, well, considered very important. Another thing, of course, was that it was unexpected. In his study, Milgram predicted that maybe 1% of the American population was willing to do things like this. So he was extremely surprised when this came out as extreme as it did. It's been reported in game shows and stuff like that, similar things, actually. There was a French game show some 10 years ago, I think, that redid this, and the results were quite similar. More than half of the population was willing to do this, trusting their authorities. So you're not going to do that kind of extreme research, of course. But some of the ethical considerations are there. You should plan for unexpected outcomes. You should think about potential unexpected outcomes, even if they don't show up. You should apply strategies for debriefing in situations where you are tricking people into situations they didn't expect. There are a number of issues here, of course, that needs consideration, because what about studies done over the internet where the anonymity is quite is an important aspect here. If you want to check, if you send out mails and want to see how many is willing to give away their passwords or something like that in a given situation, if you don't keep track of who was receiving these requests, how can you debrief them? How can you get back to them with the right, correct information? Well, if you can't, then you should consider another strategy, doing some other type of research or trying to find out what you're after in another way. I think I'll more or less stop there, but again, I'll point out the web pages that I showed you there. That was the web page for our data protection official. That has a lot of information, but there are another source I would like to point out as well, that are the national, that's a site funded by the Norwegian Research Council, Forskningsetiske Komiteer, where they, let me see where that is. Yeah. I've shown you some information from them on our Fronter pages. These committees for research ethics, there are different for different areas of research. There's one for science and technology, there's one for medical research, there's one for social sciences. And they, all of them have made different types of guidelines, from leaflets up to huge collections on how to perform your research in an ethical way. So it's a good idea to take a look at this that has on the part of that, at least, that has to do with your field of research. And all these research ethical committees together have made some general guidelines for research ethics, for instance. That should apply for all types of research. And they have, for instance, four principles here. Respect, you should think about your consequences and they should be good. Good research should be fair. And researchers should protect their integrity as researchers and not be put into situations where they selectively only publish results that is favorable for based on their loyalties. So I encourage you to read these things yourself. Ethics is important in research. Okay, that was it for today. Just a reminder, the groups here that has not done statistics with me and has not made appointments for doing statistics, make sure that you do that. I'm here late today and most of tomorrow, so we should be able to get through all groups by then. So make these appointments. Next week there will be the different groups will present their small projects here. There will also be, I will also open for some questions on the exam and stuff like that. There is a few days till the exam after next presentation. Okay, thanks.